Coben. Coben. Are you awake? Coben, are you awake?
No, I'm sleeping. What do you want?
It's been some time, Coben. This next operative is of a very demanding nature.
Ultimate weapon.
Oh, fine. What is the next operative to complete? You were assigned to visit London. This region requires principalities of a different type, but there is one apprehension. There is one single entity you must face.
He should be of no import.
Dominic Pernilius.
Yes. I shall see to it that the gate opens.
That looked like LA, you know, like someplace atop Silver Lake or Mount Washington, but it just looked older. It looked really peaceful, and everyone was out. And then it seemed like across from the sea, there was this huge wave. And as it was approaching our shores, everyone started to panic. And I didn't know why everyone was rushing away. For some reason, it didn't seem that dangerous. And then I find myself on the 5 freeway. almost home because it's that point where it divides at the interchange between the 10 East and the 60. I know like more than half my friends take the 60 on the way home, but I always take the 5. And it was nighttime, and it just felt like another night on the way home from LA. I was really relieved, like I always am at that point. And then the cars in front of me started to lift off the ground and form into an organized wreck. And I thought, just when I was about to get home, me and a group of people were in a big metal container, and we were floating over all of these perils, from waves to extraordinary heights. We were locked into this thing. And then in the front, it was like a movie theater. So there was seating. It felt like Fear Factor. I didn't know why anyone was really panicking. And then this guy in front of me lost his head.
Abstract Motif.
Well, 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 look who it is. It's you guys. Thanks so much for stopping by. This is the Abstract Motif. Oh man, I really wish it hadn't been this long. But a lot of stuff has been going on. A lot of stuff has been going on in the world. Wow. Like, the world has changed greatly since I last spoke to you guys. The date is April 10th. It's a wonderful Friday. And it's been rainy recently. But it's also a global quarantine. Because of an allegedly, reportedly malicious, nefarious pandemic. But anyway, to give us the scoop on other current events, here is Kevin Rippendip, our very own Hood Oracle.
De tu no mete cabra, Consuela, beef, future beef, Psycho Realm Revolution, the return of Jesus Christ. No dejes que se apaguen, no. On ZZ, I gotta take the mask off on 80. On I called it, on when I take my mask off, it's an 80 Jesus Kobe. Seven plagues. On the big pun, off with your head, 9 out of 10. 9 out of 28 only on N1 substitution. On extra, extra ET, Jesus Christ tip. On the Father of Christ, Angel de Maria. Look. That means Jesus is gonna come back when we need oxygen masks. And that's about it. On Mujeres in the Club beef. On God Will Rise, Eddie Bumpton, SKM Death Ruiz, this is it. So just have faith, and that's that. On like a light. Cause once it's black, it never goes back, it never turns white. On Michael Jackson, Technique Rich Gang. After circumcision, cause the angel of light. At his age 19, he was saying he was Satan. He got it right. He got Eve pregnant one time. He was the one that fucked Eve. and Adam's kids. That's why nobody liked them. He bit Tupac's dick off. Amaka de Maria Virgin Mary exalted me already and proved my innocence on Fusion. Shady blackout the lights. Because blackouts exist, and neglect exists, and blood exists. Mine's not blood. It's electricity and a tongue or rustling on the side mafia. Also, I predicted it. I actually bombed them so kids will stay in school without getting tossed up and going to hell, getting burned and raped forever.
Thank you very much for that, Kevin. Now, because so much has been going on and it's been like the epitome of controversial, I should say, this virus has blown through the globe. It's insane, and everyone has their own opinion, and there's like nothing but intense speculation. And I thought it would be appropriate to read from one of the most interesting books I've ever... Oh, excuse me. We're not getting to that point yet. But because of so much of the news we've been receiving has come from the news, I thought it would be interesting to take a look at subliminal advertising, because I feel like my opinion is definitely not popular. I'm not going to lie about that, and I'm not saying I'm right, but there's just... I think it's important to understand that a lot of stuff can be perceived via the television that kind of sets into the mind and begins to shape our worldview. And I'm pulling up this article by Philip Merkel from the University of Waterloo Department of Psychology. And he states that a form of subliminal messaging commonly believed to exist involves the insertion of hidden messages into movies and TV programs. The concept of moving pictures relies on persistence of vision to create the illusion of a movement in series of images projected at 23 to 30 frames per second. Let's see. During the 2000 U.S. presidential campaign, a television campaign for the Republican candidate George W. Bush showed words and part thereof scaling from the foreground to the background on a television screen. When the word bureaucrats flashed on the screen, one frame showed only the last part, rats. Democrats promptly asked the FCC to look into the matter, but no penalties were ever assessed in the case. The effects this had on the overall presidential race was unclear. The Democrats and Al Gore received ridicule for finding malicious intent in something that could have been a simple mistake. The Republicans received ridicule for the lack of attention to detail and Bush's mispronunciation of subliminal. It came out as sublinable. Yeah, so, I mean, I think that's a really petty example, to be honest. I mean, I don't watch a lot of TV, but when I've caught family watching the news, I see some really eerie things pop up. Apparently we've had a history in the United States of subliminal programming. There's that famous, I don't know if it's in this article, but there was supposed to be a famous Coca-Cola ad. I'm sure we've all heard about that, but, I think there's a lot more insidious stuff going on. There's a lot of neuro-linguistic programming. Let's see if we could just type that up on the spot here. Neuro-linguistic See, I don't want to really, I want to find something that's a bit more credible. I know that a lot of what I'm going to be talking today is about critical thinking as the way the way I've come to learn about it. And okay, well, let's just take a look. This is like some ultraculture.org. I don't know what this is, but neuro-linguistic programming is a marketing term for a science, quote-unquote, that two Californians, Richard Bandler and John Grinder, came up with in the 1970s. Bandler was a stoner student at UC Santa Cruz, then a mecca for psychedelics, blah, 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 blah. Let's see. So NLP is taught in a pyramid structure with more advanced techniques reserved for multi-thousand-dollar seminars to oversimplify and overcomplicate a subject. It more or less works like this. First, the user NLP-er, as NLP people often refer to themselves. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. A, what side of the brain a person is predominantly using. B, what sense, sight, smell, etc. is most predominant in their brain. C, how their brain stores and utilizes information. All of this can be gleaned from eye movements. And I've heard about this. A lot of salespeople use these tactics. That's what I learned when I was in sales. Thank God that's over. D, when they're lying or making information up. Okay, by mirroring body language, blah, 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 blah. Okay, how can I make sure nobody pulls this horse shit on me? Be extremely wary of people copying your body language. Move your eyes in random and unpredictable patterns. Do not let anybody touch you. Be wary of it. So this is all like kinesic. This is all be wary of gibberish. Nonsense phrases like, as you release this feeling more and more, you will find yourself moving into a present state of alignment with the sound of your success more and more. This kind of gibberish is the bread and butter of the pacing and leading phase of NLP. The hypnotist isn't actually saying anything. They're just trying to program your internal emotional states and move you toward where they want you to go. Always say, can you be more specific about that? Okay. Read between the lines. Oh, here. Okay. NLP people will consistently use language with hidden or layered meanings. For instance, diet, nutrition, and sleep with me are the most important things, don't you think? On the surface, if you heard this sentence quickly, it would seem like an obvious statement that you would probably agree without much thought. Yes, of course, diet, nutrition, and sleep are more important things, sure. And this person's really into being healthy. That's great. But what's the layered message? Diet, nutrition, and in bold, sleep with me. I didn't even catch that. Are the most important things, don't you think? Yep, and you unconsciously agreed to it. Skilled NLPers, okay. Okay, so, I mean, there's really no basis to this. This isn't necessarily written by any kind of scientist or anything like that. I don't know if there's any empirical evidence attached to this, but what I've kind of gathered is that through my experience about reading about psychological stuff and whatever, is that the stuff that you read and absorb emotionally, as well as the stuff you listen to, eventually may in fact influence you. And I did this about a month ago. I started using these audio auto suggestion tracks, songs that I made for myself. I just kind of was like trying to hypnotize myself. So I made these tracks that featured affirmations, and like, wouldn't you really know it? Like that shit started to come true. And I was kind of fascinated by it. You know, I mean, I've also been keeping an audio journal, and I've been tracking my progress, and most of the affirmations I've laid out have actually come to fruition. And I've noticed a lot of stuff. And the reason why I decided to do this is because before, about a couple weeks prior, I noticed myself, because I'd been meditating a lot too, I'd been noticing a lot of song lyrics stuck in my head. And I'd find myself enacting out some of those scenarios. I'm not saying that I would trap out of my house or, just live like a weird rap lifestyle. It's not even like that. It's just, there are certain things that were more closely in line with my character that I'd find myself more influenced towards doing. And, I think that no matter what you see, it will create some sort of imprint. Let's see here. And the reason why I bring that up is because when I saw my parents watching TV and they were watching COVID-19 coverage, there was this really weird situation to where they had this segment coming up about not panicking. And they had a lead-in story. The next thing, they literally jumped into this next segment. And mind you, these people are reading from a teleprompter. They're not, I shouldn't have to remind you, but they're not coming off the cuff with this stuff, which means it's written. It's conceived to do this, to formulate this kind of effect. But in the segment in between where they're leading up into the Do Not Panic segment, they jumped into the world as we know it will change at midnight tonight. And I forgot what they said after, but the thing is, that's not the point, because that relates directly to that little NLP thing that we just read right now. Which is like, what was it? The sleep with me thing, they just jumped into that. And I thought it was so creepy because that statement in itself is designed to make you panic. The world will change. Okay, well, under the context of there being a global pandemic, you don't want to hear that. And then they have this, apparently he was an attorney psychologist up next, giving everyone advice on how to not panic. And again, like I'm aware that this is all entirely my opinion. So what I have seen is under my bias. But you then are exposed to this scenario, which they're televising, which is known as an appeal to authority. So if someone offers you these credentials, I mean, to be honest, you are probably most likely going to take advice from the person who seems more qualified. But in this scenario, when you're watching media, I think that should be kind of, I think media companies essentially cherry pick the types of informants they have on anyway. So that's another lurking variable, or that's another factor to consider when looking at some sort of agency, is which expert are you actually getting the facts from? Because that may have an ideological bias to it, that individual at least. And then it's pretty much just really run-of-the-mill advice he gave anyway. And then on another night, I turned on the news just to see what was going on, and it seemed as though like this was completely unrelated to what they were talking about on the screen, but they had a headline that read, like in bold on the screen, "A New Reality." Okay, that's an intensely profound statement to print. A new reality. You could say a new era. You can say a new generation, a new paradigm, a new reality. Okay, so that the reality is the fabric in which we are living a conscious life. A new reality. This is where words, the meaning of words and how we understand them as a culture, as a collective, There's this word that I wanted to look up too. I think it's semantic mill. Where was it? Well, anyway, it was something mill, but it was something I picked up in a linguistics course, which is, I think right now, everyone would really benefit in reading up on linguistics in relation to critical thinking, because that's something that's, wow, like you just see, fortunately, critical thinking or critical reasoning or whatever, it was taught with general education when I first went into Long Beach State. And so I was able to, I failed at that, I think. So I think I got a D. But I do remember some of the basic points. And that doesn't mean I don't know how to think. So don't think just because I failed the class that I don't know how to think. Okay, so judgmental idiots. Just kidding. And anyway, but the linguistics class was more recent, because that was when I was tackling my upper division courses. And there was something regarding a mill, semantic mill or something like that. Well, anyway, semantics is when you are able to, like the meaning that words have, okay? So, for example, a queen is someone, is a female, what is it? The main female matriarch in a monarchy. I think that's the best way I can put it up on the spot right now. But queen nowadays is actually appropriated in youth culture as a dignified woman of any age that's high in self-esteem, unapologetic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the semantics have changed a bit with that. Of course, you can spell queen with a K and it, you know, it becomes kitsch. I believe that might be the right word. Or it becomes something. It's it's a form of jargon. Excuse me. It's a form of slang now. And that's there's a difference in semantics nowadays with that word. But that's just one specific example. I think that there is a lot of semantic manipulation going on. I think that, there's a lot of, well, I mean, there's a lot of interesting toying with the facts that we've seen. I've also noticed a few celebrities that have died over the virus. I've looked at several articles, and a lot of the articles, sometimes it seems like they were just completely copied and pasted, which is really, really strange. And then there's also the legal semantic issues with what are complications to the virus. You know, I mean, the thing is, I don't know. I really don't know. The thing is, a lot of media companies, I mean, this goes for both sides of the coin. They're either more liberal or they're more focused on having a conservative slant to sway certain ideas. I mean, I don't know. It's just, there's a lot of ideology and corporate competition that means that the media itself is completely, it's very unreliable. And if you look at what media is, it's just representative of content, isn't it? I mean, media is just a form of, it's not really even news per se. You know, a lot of people say they watch the news to be informed, but it seems like the bias is so great, you're not even looking at an opinion. You're looking at an active distortion of the truth, it seems, you know? That's what we're looking at. And that's why, personally, I mean, some of the news is unavoidable. I mean, before I really dive into a topic, I mean, I admit that I get a lot of my news from memes. And then if it seems like an important topic, I will begin to dig into people who devote themselves to news. But also another thing is, it seems like we are unconsciously, or sometimes subconsciously or even consciously, swerved towards an ideology or towards a standpoint on an event like this by influencers, celebrities, social media influencers, etc. And the thing is, influencers in themselves cannot be honest, because if they were to doubt something like this pandemic, they would more than likely be criticized for insensitivity. Even when I just posted something for my friends on Instagram, some people say, like, dude, people are dying. But yeah, I mean, and it's true, people are dying, and this is a very trite example, but it seems like the numbers aren't necessarily higher than they've been for other epidemics, pandemics, or even the seasonal flu in some places. Furthermore, I mean, do the numbers really correlate? I have a French friend, and I asked her about the situation over there, and she said, oh yeah, it's really bad. There's 50 people that passed away last night, and there's a 16-year-old girl that died. And I was like, really? Okay, let me see the article, please. And so I had to translate it from French, and not mean Google Chrome. And she was basically parroting the article. And that's fine, that's where you get your facts, but this is cherry picking, because the anomaly sometimes proves the rule. And this was used as a headline. This was sensationalized. This was highlighted. This was emphasized to draw your attention towards the anomaly, to draw your attention towards the rarity, it seems. So do the numbers really correlate? Well, you know, around that time, it was a week ago, there was like 400 people dying a day from the coronavirus in the United States. Maybe it's higher now. I haven't really been checking too much, because I know that I just find it strange that the numbers will rise, but where are they being scaled from? I'm sure you can remember at one point there was a headline saying the first case of coronavirus in 10th case of corona, first 100 people infected of coronavirus in, but that's scaled to 1 or 0. In 2017, there were 7,700 deaths in the United States per day on average. I'm sure a huge number of these, especially during flu season, were due to flu complications. So do the numbers really correlate? Are we being informed, or are we being persuaded? There's a book called One Up on Wall Street, written by, I own this book. I should know this off the top of my head. He was a hedge fund manager, Peter Lynch, legendary. And there was one chapter, I'm not going to dig it up right now. It's behind me, but I'm not going to go dig it up. But if you really, really want to know where it is, you can just ask me, and I can find me on Instagram at Paul Espinoza. You could find me and ask me where it is, or you could just read it yourself. There's a small section in the book where he talks about repeat business and the right companies to invest in. And he mentions that the right pharmaceutical company to invest in is one that provides repeat business, because the medicine that heals is good for the patient, but not for the investor. And what I mean by that is that I think that with this media bombardment we've been getting, I don't think it's information. Like I said before, I think it's purposely a distortion of the truth. I think that there's like a, that's like the dichotomy of what truth is, isn't it? Or it could be something along those lines. Truth versus deception. Information versus persuasion for interest. I've never been one to entertain any kind of conspiracies more than just the random YouTube videos I'd watch every one in every 6 months, or discuss weird ideas with friends just either while stoned or like having like a few beers or something like that. I've never been into this, but what I do find interesting is that if we are being persuaded for something, it means that we are being led to believe a certain idea for a reason. This is conspiring. And because of this, now we have to look at something a bit differently, is that there is a semantic manipulation against a type of individual. Like if we look at a few different words, like camera, piano, theory, hypothesis, all these words are essentially, I mean, they don't really necessarily have a charge unless you had some sort of related trauma to them. But if you look at another set of words, pen, book, desk, guitar, man, conspiracy. Well, conspiracy sounds pretty rough. I mean, it sounds sketchy, but it also sounds like paranoia to a lot of people. And conspiracy theorist in itself immediately leaves one to be blacklisted from any kind of discussion that most people would probably believe. And I was never really one to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I believe, I'm not going to say that there is an element of truth in everything, unless you want to get really, really philosophical on some stuff. But I am one who believes that pathologies within the individual can also be reflected and projected out into greater society. I think there are great evils in this world. And I think in these times, it may be naive to believe that people in higher positions have the best interest for us. It was less than 100 years ago that entire peoples, I mean, and throughout the 100 years since, that people have been exterminated in mass. I believe that intellect, and what I mean by intellect is the ability to reason and to disarm vagaries in communications and facts, is this kind of intellect is the sword, and it's used to deconstruct. It's used to cut away the unnecessary to get to the pith of matters. The reason why I brought that bit up on evil is because, you know, I saw something very interesting on the internet. And it's from Parliament's website, parliament.uk. It's a bill being passed relevant to what's going on right now. Now I'm just going to pull it up on my phone. Right. Among other things, and looking in this bill, it's really, really creepy. And you can find it yourself, parliament.uk. It's the coronavirus bill of 2020. And here in Schedule 12, Registration of Deaths and Stillbirths, Part 1 for England and Wales, here's the heading, giving information that other than in person and dispensing with signaling register. A qualified informant who is required under the 1953 Act to give information about a death or stillbirth to register may give the information to the registrar by phone, telephone, blah, 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 blah. Okay, here's where it gets dark. Medical certificates of cause of death. Section 4, Part 2, a registered medical practitioner X, who is not the practitioner who attended the deceased person, D, during D's last illness, may sign a certificate under Section 22.1 of the 1953 Act, Certificates of Cause of Death, A. The practitioner who attended D is unable to sign the certificate, or it is impractical for the practitioner to sign the certificate, and B, X is able to state the best of X's knowledge, to the best of X's knowledge and belief, the cause of death. Okay, so this kind of opens up a can of worms here. And then you also have this, this is 7, registration of deaths to stillbirths. Okay, number 18. Confirmatory medical certificates not required for cremations, England and Wales. Regulation 16 of the Cremation England and Wales, Regulations 2008, which sets out preconditions for the cremation of remains of a deceased person, has effect as if paragraph 1 did not require a confirmatory medical certificate to be given in accordance with regulation of the regulations. Okay, so this is really creepy stuff. Power to alter expiry date. That's also really creepy. There was also, I mean, there's tons of stuff on here. I mean, if you read through this thing, which I encourage you to do if you're interested, and if you don't believe it yourself, there's a section where essentially officers of the law don't have to treat you with any kind of dignity or respect, according to the care law or something like that. And yet another section which states that any medical practitioner can accuse you of being a threat to society or accusing you of mental illness because basically they can, because of the coronavirus bill, they can pretty much accuse you of being ill or a potential threat to safety whenever they want. Yeah, it's just really, it's a really heavy idea. It's a really heavy topic. Oh, this is pretty cool. This is something I wanted to share. This is from Language and Thought in Action. I really like this book. This is S.I. Hayakawa, and it's an it's a linguistics book that I got in 2010, and for some reason I wanted to read. I don't know why I wanted to read it, but it's something that was just, it was really, this is the book that taught me that words are not the things that they represent, which is a very deep deep tool to use. And that's what really got me into perceiving semantic manipulation around me, because once you start to understand that objects are inherently just those objects alone, and like we give them power by naming them, and we can also, what you understand, you can manipulate, you know, like you can make good words dirty words if you will them to be. And I'm going back to semantic manipulation right now, but the whole safer at home law or safer at home ordinance could be perceived as quarantine. It could be perceived as house arrest. There's really not much more to that. It's pretty, and it gets a bit more confusing when those things represented by words are not physical and cannot be seen. They're just ideas or laws. Is it protection or restriction? I mean, I know my biases, but I'm just asking the question. And where are the lines drawn? And in regards to television, this is chapter 15 of Language and Thought in Action. And this is a chapter called The Empty Eye, chapter 15. And it starts off with a quote by Mark Crispin Miller. Now that TV's content has been determined and homogenized by the commercial impetus that once merely underlay the spectacle, and now that TV's basic purpose is to keep you watching, that's important, the images all point back toward that now imperceptible managerial intention. And because TV is, on the whole, devised by and for the same class and generation, it constitutes a vehicle of collective self-allurement and self-solace, so that the spectacle has all the eerie resonance of a great bad dream. TV's images, furthermore, are all the richer in unconscious meanings for the increased sophistication of the visual technology that represents them, calculated always to jolt the nerves of the half-attentive. The spectacle is less and less elaborately scripted and plotted, while more and more reliant on stark pictures and a lightning pace, along with infectious music, and on words as blunt as pictures, such as the imperative behind all the ads and newscasts, game shows, and cartoons. And nearly all the talk shows, dramas, and sitcoms, so that TV's concentrated volume of appeal actually gives more and more away the more it tries to rush and dazzle us beyond understanding what it's all about. Now we go back to the actual writing of the book, where Hayakawa continues, modern society inundates its citizens not only with a Niagara of words, but also these days with a torrent of pictures. Television spews out both words and pictures in dizzying quantity and variety. Movies, talk shows, cartoons, dramatic programs, comedies, variety shows, children's shows and sports, sporting events, news programs, political advertisements, and incessant commercial messages. What began with a few channels in each city has become in many areas a smorgasbord of a dozen channels or more in two or three languages, some offering nonstop news, others nonstop sports, even some with nonstop advertising. Since the 1950s, this new combination of visual and verbal information, with its immediacy and effective power as well as its hypnotizing banality, has become an integral part of our lives. About 98% of Americans have a television with its empty eye staring at and the inhabitants more than 7 hours a day. Distinctions between type of programming that once were clear have become blurred. News programs, entertainment programs, and commercials have been more alike as competition for the public's attention has become more intense. Many commercials consist of vignettes told in a kind of visual shorthand that creates dramatic suspense, which is released when characters buy or consume the products being advertised. Dramatic programs like Dynasty and Miami Vice resemble long ads for high fashion clothing, fancy cars, and expensive real estate. Many game shows appear to be little more than an excuse to display new products with contestants competing breathlessly to acquire them. Political campaigns stage events that are covered by news organizations. Then the campaigns recycle the news footage into political ads. Then news organizations file reports about those political ads. Close on the heels of Happy Talk News, an attempt to make news more entertaining, comes infotainment, consisting of shows dressed up in a news program format that are little more than segments from forthcoming movies and interviews with actors and singers. Reality television, quote-unquote, also uses the news format for crime stories and gossip once the exclusive province of supermarket tabloids. Next section is called Seeing is Believing. What does television tell its viewers about the world? Beyond the data explicitly offered, Toyota-thon year-end sales extravaganza. Through Sunday only, a severe storm headed our way, details at 11. What are television's characteristics themselves contributing to the way we think about the world? Not so long ago, some people believed that if a piece of information were printed in a book, it must be true. Such an attitude still prevails with respect to television because, as everyone knows, seeing is believing. I actually overheard one shopper in a store telling another about a product. Sure, it works. Haven't you seen it on TV? Television's ability to suggest that we are actually experiencing the events depicted or at least seeing them accurately is the source of its greatest power. I'm going to read that again. Television's ability to suggest that we are actually experiencing the events depicted or at least seeing them accurately is the source of its greatest power. Television dramatic shows like movies and theatrical productions depend on viewers suspending their disbelief and identifying with characters portrayed without saying, wait a minute, people can't really beam themselves through space, or that isn't really the court of Henry VIII. It's a studio soundstage somewhere in Southern California. Although most people understand that there are differences between fictional television advertising and nonfiction or news programs, it is worthwhile examining just how each conveys its representations of reality so we can understand how and whether to believe what we see. The power of television news to capture the public's attention became apparent in the 1960s. In 1963, the nation was gripped by horror and grief at the assassination of President Kennedy. The event and its aftermath kept the nation riveted to television screens for days. Other major events, though reported in the newspapers and magazines as well, were likewise widely and instantaneously experienced on television. Several incidents occurred in 1968 alone. The first expedition to set foot on the moon, the assassinations of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, the riots of the Democratic National Convention, and North Vietnam's Tet Offensive, television coverage of which brought into American homes bloody images of war that previously had seemed quite remote. Each of these events, seen over several days by a huge section of the American public, became a part of a shared set of experiences. All seen through the eye of television. Since then, television has become the primary source of news information for a large section of the American public, with newspapers, magazines, and radio assuming supplemental roles. And that's why I wanted to get into one of my usual topics, psychological pathologies, particularly cluster Bs. And I drill that in because these pathologies culminate towards antisocial personality disorder, also known as sociopathy, and known informally and unacademically as evil, because that's what it is. This is the nature of evil, and it's been written about and compared to, it's been fabled. The vampire is essentially like, okay, list off a few sociopathic traits just to get the ball rolling here. Sociopaths aren't able to learn from their mistakes and therefore lack self-awareness. They tend to live on the fringes of society when they're not in pretty much any role of society as well, because they can climb ladders just like anyone else. They can live in an alleyway. They can live in a mansion. They can live in a White House. But a vast majority of the time, they also live in the underbellies of society. They're extremely charming. They're glib. Vampires cannot see themselves in the mirror. They cannot be exposed to sunlight because they live in the underbellies. They live in the night. They're deeply charming. Oh, yeah. Sociopaths are parasitic. Vampires suck blood. Now, just in what way the government sucks our blood, and I'm not just talking about taxes, because there's, if there are only two things certain about life, that's death and taxes, right? But there are many other ways, I'm sure. I won't get into any weird conspiracy theories because I'm not really sure about them. You know, I can't verify most of them. But gaslighting is a tool used expertly or exquisitely by sociopaths in the way that it comes from an old movie where this guy is pretty much fooling his wife or girlfriend into thinking that she's going crazy because she actually is, she's perceiving things as they really are, but he denies it, convinces her she's wrong, and she begins to lose her mind. There's been some weird stuff where I watch the news or I read the news and I'm informed of something that doesn't correlate with the numbers that I see. And I think that's so strange. Like, you know, death toll surges past 200. And then it's true. And then you say, then you see, it's like, oh, it's a very deadly disease. And you look at the numbers and you see like hundreds of thousands recovered out of hundreds of thousands that contracted it. And that's gaslighting. That's gaslighting. You're being told that something is dead. Well, I mean, the thing is, there it is, semantics. Something's deadly. So is eating wiener schnitzel. That's really fucking deadly. Have you looked at the number of deaths related to heart disease? There was that one time that, 2010, my dad broke his ankle and he caught coronavirus and had to be hospitalized. Oh, wait a second. That was the flu. And he was hospitalized twice that year. I'm not going to, you know, death is a horrible, miserable fact of life. And I don't wish it on anyone that doesn't really deserve it. And of course, to deserve it, you have to be a really, really bad piece of shit. But these numbers, what I find insensitive is gaslighting the public. What I find insensitive and cruel is making elderly populations afraid for their lives. That's what I find insensitive. I really wouldn't defend the media, and I'm not accusing any of my listeners as doing so. This is just something I'm stating. I think that people have been telling me, people have been telling me that they've been seeing people behave strangely. I mean, who are we kidding? It's really weird being cooped up, right? Especially if you're wildly extroverted. You know, it must be strange being quarantined. I've worked from home for the last few months, so it's not really much different for me altogether. And I'm usually just really, really busy doing other stuff as it is. So my life hasn't changed all that much, but I'm sure people are, you know, kind of cooped up. Maybe they're really for, I mean, I go on walks every day. I know I'm not supposed to, but I don't touch anyone. I don't come within 10, 20 feet of people anyway. So, but I think that's one of the reasons why, I mean, this is, you know, one of the main reasons that could be, but my opinion is that I believe people who are gaslighted will start to behave erratically and strangely because you are going to begin, not you, one would begin doubting their reality. And this goes right back to what you see on the television screen. A new reality. You're given facts that on their own aren't really, I mean, the thing, if you remove your emotion, if you remove emotionalism and sensationalism from the articles, you would see that these are not really astounding numbers. But the speculation is, and to go back to Peter Lynch and the work that I've learned from him, or what I've learned from him is that the way you choose a company to invest in or a mutual fund to invest in is you don't go only by speculation. That's how you lose. In order to put value into something like information or an opinion, you do fundamental analysis. Just because a company is doing well does not mean you should invest into it. You look at the fundamentals. You look at the numbers. You look at their sheet. Are they in debt? How are their earnings for the last few quarters? Are there any catalysts? Likewise, I think people are going to start looking at the media differently. I think they've lost a lot of our trust because what you're seeing is some guy who graduated from Cal State Fullerton or UCLA, communications degree. They're not a journalist. I don't think they even want to be a journalist. Because journalists are out there on the field and they're not in makeup for an hour at 7 in the morning. These people are most likely narcissists. And they're reading stuff that they're told to read most of the time. So you can rely on their speculation, which is actually not even really speculation. It's distorted facts. No matter what, no matter who you're getting it from, unless they're an independent researcher with a sense of ethics or just an all-around like quality news team, you're getting distorted facts. And sometimes there is lying by omission. It's better to do your own fundamental analysis of the numbers, no matter what. Now to lighten up the mood, here is a collaboration I worked on with an old friend, legendary Los Angeles DJ Tori Rollins. And she lent me her voice, and I made some music around it, so take a listen. Unwind and we'll get back to you soon. Thank you. actual cause of death with cholera is difficult to pinpoint. The human body's dependence on water is so profound that almost all the major systems begin to fail when so much fluid is evacuated in such a short period of time. Dying of dehydration is, in a sense, an abomination against the very origins of life on Earth. Our ancestors evolved first in the oceans of the young planet, and while some organisms manage to adapt to life on land, our bodies retain a genetic memory of their watery origin. Fertilization for all animals takes place in some form of water. Embryos float in the womb. Human blood has almost the same concentration of salts as seawater. Those animal species that fully adapt to the land did so through the trick of taking their former environment with them. The evolutionary biologist Lynn Margulis writes, "No animal has ever really completely left the watery microcosm. No matter how high and dry the mountaintop, no matter how secluded and modern the retreat, we sweat and cry what is basically seawater. The first significant effect of serious dehydration is a reduction in the volume of blood circulating through the body, the blood growing increasingly concentrated as it is deprived of water. The lowered volume causes the heart to pump faster to maintain blood pressure and keep its vital organs. The brain and the kidneys functional. In this internal triage, non-vital organs such as the gallbladder and spleen begin to shut down. Blood vessels in the extremities constrict, creating a persistent tingling sensation. Because the brain continues to survive, to receive a sufficient supply of the blood in this early stage, the cholera victim retains a sharp awareness of the attack that Vibrio cholera has launched against his body. Eventually, the heart fails in its ability to maintain adequate blood pressure and hypotension sets in. The heart pumps at a frantic rate while the kidneys struggle to conserve as much fluid as possible. The mind grows hazy. Some sufferers become lightheaded or even pass out. The terrible evacuations of rice water stools continue. By now, the cholera victim may have lost more than 10% of his body weight in a matter of 24 hours. As the kidneys finally start to fail, the bloodstream recreates. On a much smaller scale, the crisis of waste management that helped cholera thrive in so many large cities. Waste products accumulate in the blood, fostering a condition called uremia. The victim slips into unconsciousness, or even a coma. The vital organs start to shut down. Within a matter of hours, the victim is dead. But all around him, in his soaked sheets, in the buckets of rice water at his bedside, in the cesspools and sewers, are new forms of life, trillions of them, waiting patiently for another host to infect." That was an excerpt from The Ghost Map, the story of London's most terrifying epidemic and how it changed science, cities, and the modern world. This was a fantastic book. I read this for one of my urban anthropology classes, and it was incredible. It features Dr. Jon Snow. He's the one who figured out how to cure cholera, I believe, and he's also the man who developed anesthesia. Incredible inspiration to me, and I think it's because he played detective on a pathology that was destroying the world around him. And I find that incredible. And imagine just really, it's pathology really. You know, I guess I'm fascinated by pathology, diseases that spread. But the thing is, it's not, pathologies aren't always physical biomedical diseases, you know? That's another reason why I gained an appreciation, a further appreciation for London is that city, when you're over there, you feel like it's gone through the shit, you know? It's gone through disasters just like that. I mean, I think it went through cholera, the Black Plague, maybe wars, I can't remember, but the thing is, it's gone through so much, and you could kind of feel that pulsing. It's a very persistent, steadfast city. And that's why I admire it so much. And I think that it's really fascinating that certain cultures, I think it was a fabled culture. It might have been Atlantean culture or something written as some prehistoric or early historic culture that documented what was known as the mind parasite. I was really trying to get author Thomas Sheridan on my podcast this time around, but he didn't really respond too well to me. Because he's the one who mentioned this. He he spoke about it. And these people had, after like this terrible dictator was in charge, they had talked about being awakened as if that they had been afflicted by some sort of parasite that took control of their mentality. And I'm not saying that we're going through that right now, but I think that there is a parasitic aspect to the media. And again, no matter what the bias is, there is a parasitic aspect to it. It's hunting, it's vying, it's thirsting for your attention. Lately we've been quarantined in order to be inside to view this media and to keep quote unquote updated. All in all, this discussion may remind you. It sure does remind me about the term programming, television programming. I know it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but you know, I think that even if it was done with zero intent to sway an individual into any kind of philosophy or social standpoint, it is programming. Like these pandemics and epidemics and so on, I think that the current pandemic is truly fear. I am totally for taking precautions, but I am not really a fan of being subjected to sadistic fear-mongering practices. That's something that's actually a psychological form of torture, and I think that there's going to be a lot of people that come out of this, especially people within the ages of 0 to 15, 0 to 16 maybe even earlier, I don't know, that come out of this with some sort of complex PTSD. And I think that's what's happened to a lot of our generation and younger with 9/11. I think that's why we get that's one of the reasons why we may have a lot of collective anxiety, sense of impending doom. Since I've been meditating, I've been noticing a lot more. I don't know if you've ever meditated. I'm sure everyone has tried to some level meditation. But it's interesting because I'm sure you might recall the times you've tried meditation, or if you do it regularly, how thoughts, discursive thoughts, flow in and out of the mind, and sometimes they just keep repeating. And sometimes, like, that earworm that you had of a song that's been in your mind all week is really an ear fucking worm. It's really digging in there. And I've also been paying attention to my dreams. And it's funny how the subconscious and the dreams are connected. And oftentimes psychologists, well, not even really psychologists, but a lot of woo-woo practitioner types, and I'm kind of a fan of the woo-woo myself, they suggest that you're basically acting out your programs from your subconscious mind. But what's really safeguarding that? Because these woo-woo types are the spiritual types, maybe even certain teachings in the Vedas suggest that, you know, the subconscious mind is kind of like a child. It doesn't really know what's true or not. That's why it's important to hear no evil, see no evil, and speak no evil, because the subconscious mind is impressionable. And when you enter the dream space, I mean, are you also creating these programs? Are you compounding them? Or are you sorting through them? Who knows? Some people believe it's sorting out old issues. I've had that experience. Some people believe it's a sign of things to come. The segment in the beginning, talking about the city and the wave from overseas. And the traffic jam, the controlled chaos. And the container housing everyone was actually a set of dreams I had about 2 to 3 months ago. And I didn't understand what they meant. Until one day, when I got a call from family saying that I should be careful about this epidemic coming over from China. But I didn't seem to worry about it. And then one day I caught myself walking home from the gym, or actually the closed gym. I was just going for a walk. And I had started a venture on March 1st, 2020. And I thought, dude, I was so close. I was in the home stretch. And then all of a sudden, out of my control, life jams me up with these circumstances. And it's nothing personal. It just seemed like controlled chaos, really. And then yet another time, I found myself experiencing a global lockdown, a quarantine, tucked away in a box, and experiencing friends begin to lose their minds, albeit temporarily. So I don't know, sometimes I think dreams are a bit more than just the mind playing, or the mind processing old fears or desires. And that's why it's important to guard what goes into it. Because the virus nowadays isn't one that spawns from pestilence, some from filth, as much as it is fear and corporate interests. So I suggest just being weary of how much time you spend in a fear box, and make sure that the chaos in your life isn't being caused by the hands that don't have your best interest at heart.